Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the Wax Cast podcast. I am your host, Gavin Wax. This is episode 17, I believe. And today I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Buca Lupo, or Boca Lupo, or Boca, whatever the hell you want to call it, depending on the Italian accent I guess you're using, Sofia Carbone. I wanted to bring her on to talk about feminism, pasta-making recipes, Italian politics, and whatever else we want to talk about in this crazy podcast discussion. Let's see what happens. Anyway, Sofia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Gavin.
So let's start off with an easy question, just to, you know, get everything started smoothly, you know, nothing too controversial. Why should women be in the kitchen?
Women should be in the kitchen because it's where they're happiest. If you look less than half a century ago, women were much happier than they are today. We're funneling women into the workplace, something that goes against their biological and psychological predisposition. Women are nurturers. There are some exceptions. Some women do excel in STEM. It happens. That is an exception. However, naturally, typically the norm is women want to, if they go into the workforce, they want jobs as social workers, as nurses, something that's nurturing, something that mimics motherhood, that mimics homemaking. That's where women are really happiest. And we created a society that demonizes that, does not make it economically feasible to have a single income household in a lot of locations. And a society that rejects traditional gender roles, something that supports nuclear family and supports civilization as a whole.
So you're trying to tell me that there's actually a difference between the sexes? Is that what you're saying?
There is. And there's only two of them.
Wow. So there are preferences between men and women that differ, that there are biological differences, and then women may have a natural disposition towards, you know, a certain field or a certain way of life, and men may have, on the whole, obviously it's not a universal, it's a general fact, may have other differences in terms of how they want to pursue their life. And are you trying to say that corporate America, the left-wing academia, big business, et cetera, are purposely pushing these sort of unnatural lifestyles and lifestyles that people wouldn't, you know, organically choose in order to maybe line their own pockets, in order to benefit themselves at the expense of women, families, and society as a whole?
100% they are. You see left-wing institutions like academia, the media, they're pushing Harry Styles in a dress. They're pushing women into STEM, funneling them into the workforce. It happens in, you know, elementary school, pushing women in STEM courses and classes and projects and field trips, stuff like that. They're looking to emasculate men and effeminate women and make this gender neutral society that does not have a balance of the sexes. And when you don't have that balance, you don't have a stable nuclear family and you don't have a stable society. They're trying to line their pockets, like you said. They're trying to push us to be dependent on the government, to be dependent on large institutions, corporate America, and they don't want a happy nuclear family that when you're having kids, you're having a stay-at-home mom or some sort of stay-at-home
tradition. But doesn't that kind of come down to maybe a difference between, say, people who are more inclined to social conservatism and people who are more socially left-wing, that the basis of society is not necessarily the individual, it's really the family. And the nuclear family is the basis of civilization, of nations, et cetera. And they're trying to just make everything about just, you know, living in the moment, individualize everything to like this kind of extreme extent. And obviously, the United States is an individualistic nation, but that doesn't mean we've rejected the concept of family. We've rejected the concept of tradition and all the values that entails and all the great benefits that brings to society. Do you think that's part of this?
Yes, 100%. I mean, you look at college. College was originally created to be a second step for people that needed a degree to practice, like doctors, like most lawyers, that kind of thing. And we, like you said, move towards an individualistic society instead of a family-based society. They want women to go to college. They want to push back the age that people get married, that they have kids, that families are made, delay it to the point where, you know, these women who didn't necessarily, you know, maybe they don't want to go to college in the first place, they end up graduating with all this debt, having to work through it. And they're unmarried 35-year-old women that don't have
I mean, that, like you said, are the reason there's rising depression and rising levels of just unhappiness, particularly among females. If you look over the data over the last few decades, I mean, it's pretty stark. I mean, you see obviously similar trends across both genders, all two of them, but it's not as stark of an increase as, say, women, particularly in major cosmopolitan areas, major urban areas where, like you're saying, people have been told their whole lives, like, if you really want to be successful, if you want to be happy, work in a cubicle, work in a corporate job, put everything about your career and profession until you're 30 and forget families, and families are evil, marriage is evil, all that kind of stuff. And maybe some people bought into that. Maybe some people really believe it, but it's certainly leading to some massive issues in society.
100%. You know, 100, even 50 years ago, people were getting married much younger. They were having kids much younger. Today, they're going to college. They're not actually getting out there to where they're not economically stable to be able to, men aren't economically stable and independent to be able to support a family anymore. And even women are trying to get economically stable themselves to where they can move back into the household. They can be homemakers. They can be remote and part-time workers, but they can't dedicate themselves to raising children because they've dedicated the first few decades of their lives to education and the workforce where they were unhappy.
And it's not even really education. I mean, most of it is just, you know, nonsense. That's propaganda. And most people leave these institutions of higher learning dumber than when they went in. And they probably would have been better off either starting a family, starting a business, or just working for men and women than they ever were going into there and just getting laden with debt and mortgages. And that's the economic component that you started to touch on. We used to have a situation where one income would be enough to support a middle class lifestyle with multiple children. Now you can have two incomes, two people working full time, and you could barely support one child, let alone any child. I mean, that's not a healthy society. Society that can't have families is not a society that's going to last long. I mean, that's just basic, you know, law of the jungle, and just, you know, going back to, you know, the basics of human civilization. I mean, if you cannot have a growing population, you are going to, you know, be erased by societies and civilizations that do have growing populations.
Exactly. And it's the propaganda's in school, people would be much better skipping college and working. I cannot tell you how many business owners that I've talked to, or editors, or any kind of employer, whether it be journalism, businesses, private businesses, a whole array of things. They all say that they'd rather hire younger people who haven't gone to college simply because they don't want to retrain them. College isn't teaching them the proper way to do things in the modern world, in the real world. So they actually have to, even journalists, they're unteaching these kids how they learn to write, and they have to reteach them. They're like, we'd rather just start from scratch and teach them straight out of high school or after they've interned somewhere than have to strip it all down and start over.
Self-education is way better, learning on your own or just learning through actually working at all these theoretical classes. I mean, maybe 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, these degrees and these programs at these schools were worth something before we basically made college like the standard. College used to be something that not everyone did. It was something that, you know, only a segment of the population did. It was extremely rigorous. It was much more selective. And if you did it, it was more focused on, you know, a specific field. Now it's just become everyone does it. So it obviously has to devalue the quality of the education. So it's a horrible thing. But I also want to touch on policy for a second. Do you think, say, the Republican Party or whoever should put a bigger emphasis and say, policies that would encourage families, encourage larger families, natalism, things like that? I know when Trump first got in, there was talk of, say, paid maternity leave, things like that. How do you feel about a certain policy from the government that would encourage or stimulate birth rates and family creation?
I think that we should definitely be talking about certain policies. What that policy is really depends on the national discussion. I've had some people, when I posted different hits of mine talking about gender roles, them kind of coming back at me and saying, well, you're not ready for the economic discussion. Well, I am. I know we need to have an economic discussion and I'm ready to have it, but a lot of people aren't. A lot of society isn't. And we can't really say, although there should be certain policies that are put in place, and it will vary depending on the situation, but until you create a demand for those policies and for the economic discussion, it's not going to happen. And you have to create a national demand for it by making traditional gender roles acceptable again, by stop demonizing men who have male confidence, who want to be providers, and stop demonizing women who want to be homemakers and want to be mothers.
Right. And I think it comes down to, you know, they're always saying they're pro-choice, but they're not pro-choice when it comes to lifestyles, because, you know, it'd be one thing if, you know, this left-wing society would be willing just to do their own thing in their own little corner of the country or their own segment of society. And then they would leave, you know, the rest of the country or the rest of society that wants to engage in more traditional living, more traditional lifestyles, et cetera. But they don't even want that. They don't want a separation. They don't want to be peaceful. They want to force their worldview, their regressive views, their ideas about society on everybody, which is really what this comes down to. Because I think most people on the right, most people who are more conservative or traditional, would be fine with just separating, living their own life, and just living in peace. But the left won't accept that. That's what this really comes down to, because they need to force their ideas on everyone, which is almost kind of counterintuitive, don't you think? Because if their ideas were so great, people would naturally be inclined to accept them, but they have to use force and coercion, and they have to demonize the other side in order to get any adherence to this sort of worldview.
You're exactly right. And I've had women come up to me and say, you know, you want to force everyone in the kitchen. I don't want to force all women in the kitchen. I have many friends who want to go into STEM, and there are some women who that's where they excel. That's fine. It's an exception to the norm. Perfectly okay. But myself, a lot of my friends, people have come up to me and say, like, thank you for standing up for traditional gender roles, because we're demonized for it. We're told we can't do it. We're told it's historic, that old thought, it's harmful, it's dangerous. And that's not okay. You know, the left gets mad at us for being intolerant, when really they're the ones that are threatening women who want to be mothers, who want to raise families. So much for women supporting women, but
no, it's a total lie. I mean, sometimes women are the nastiest to other women. I mean, and that's the whole thing with politics. I mean, always, oh, we'll put a female candidate up and women will vote for them. And they generally don't. If you look at the numbers, it's like the exact opposite. But no, I mean, this is all, it's all kind of sad. And people talk about, you know, no one is demonizing. No one is going after the women who choose to go into, you know, a STEM field or choose to pursue a career, and they're good at it and they do well and they're successful, whatever, start a business. No one demonizes them. And if you want to do that, that's great. The problem is that they're always demonizing the people that don't choose to do that. They just want to be, say, a mother, start a family, et cetera. That's where there's this sort of hypocrisy that's going on, that they're trying to paint anyone who advocates like yourself for more tradition in society as the bad guys. But you're never going out and attacking people for making their own life choices. You're just saying, let us make our own life choices. And it just so happens that these life choices would be the more popular decision people would make if we really lived in a free society that allowed, you know, a free exchange of ideas and all the rest. But the other thing is, I think a lot of people, especially in the culture, they kind of maybe give more of these unrealistic expectations to women. They say that, you know, you can pursue maybe this kind of career or this lifestyle, and you could still have a family after like 20 so years. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you're kind of setting this bar that's almost impossible to reach outside of like a few TV shows, that you want to live like this kind of cosmopolitan urban lifestyle with your high paced job, but you're also going to have a family. It's like, well, you should be realistic when you tell people these sort of things, because if they're going to base their whole life on that, it ends up not being something that's feasible. That really hurts. I mean, am I wrong in saying that?
No, you're 100% right. I mean, whether it's from the economic standpoint, the time management standpoint, and like you said, they push women back 20 years to start a family, and void of the economic and time issues, you just get tired. People get older, they get tired. Like, there's a reason that when society was completely traditional gender roles, like based on the nuclear family, people were having kids so young, people were getting married young, because they had the energy to be able to take care of the home, to work, to raise the children, to teach them, to do all this. So you're tiring out women, you're stretching them thin economically, you're completely breaking apart the nuclear family. Also, when you're putting women into the workplace for 10, 20 years prior to starting a family, that creates habits, that creates different, it has a psychological effect. So you're messing with, even if there is a nuclear family eventually, you're messing with the structure and the balance of it, because you no longer have that provider homemaker mindset. It's now kind of a dual, you're still going into it with a dual provider mindset.
And that may be why we see a lot of, you know, rising divorces, divorce rate and broken families and separation, which is a whole other topic that has also been hurting society, you know, the rates of single motherhood and all that. I mean, that's another, it very much tied with what we're talking about. But what's funny is that all these concepts that we're speaking about are all relatively recent. I mean, you know, this whole notion of, you know, what's quote unquote called modernity in terms of, you know, the gender roles and the family and how society is structured is, it's not even a generation old. I mean, we're talking about a matter of decades, really. I mean, especially even in the West, I mean, but most of the world, most of our history, human history has never been based around this. We're really engaging in this sort of mass experiment where we're basically we're applying these sort of like left wing sociological concepts to society at large and just seeing, oh, let's see what happens. Let's see if we destroy gender roles. Let's see if we destroy the nuclear family. I hope nothing bad happens. I mean, this is, we're playing with fire because we're going against thousands of years of human development. I mean, am I right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think you see going back to the First World War, especially when women and the Second World War, women had to start entering their workplace more and taking on that role because so many of our men were away overseas. Women took up the workforce role, and that's fine. That's needed, understood. But then the left capitalized on it. Right. And they started to use that to slowly keep women in society, in the workforce, slowly keep women like integrating that progressive concept into society and making it seem normal. So then in the last couple of decades, they sent it into overdrive with, you know, now we're seeing Harry Styles on the cover of Vogue in a dress. Like, we went from women taking up men's jobs when they were away fighting wars to the men wearing dresses. I don't see how that's any way beneficial, but...
Isn't that the whole corruption of this whole concept of feminism? I mean, I can understand, you know, maybe the original waves of feminism, you know, fighting for equality under the law. These are all great concepts, whatever. And, you know, maybe cherishing femininity. But now it's completely turned upside down where, you know, there's no objective standard of what it is to be a woman anymore. Anyone can self-identify as a woman. Anyone could be a woman. Men can have babies, apparently. Men can wear women's clothes. I mean, they're destroying, men can compete in women's sports. So they're destroying, you know, they're really destroying, if you want to look at the root of the word feminism, they're attacking what feminism really is when it comes down to it, not these modern interpretations of it. And at the same time, it's also part of a larger war on men and war on masculinity and war on boys. I mean, it's coming from both sides here. And I think a lot of people are ignorant to it, and it's really screwing society up. I mean, trying to like just glorify, you know, wearing a dress and making it seem like it's edgy or whatever, it's just so stupid and like phony.
Yes, and like you said, they're taking away femininity. Like they're not trying to promote it. If you're, feminism should be, if you just think, look, it should be something. It should be cherishing femininity. It should be letting women express that, letting them, you know, be feminine, follow their biological predispositions, let them be mothers, let them wear dresses. And but all feminists have blue hair that's cut as short as can be, shaved heads, like they dress as men, and then you see men dressing as what it's a total reversal insanity of what the word should be.
And none of them are happy. Like, we just to bring it back to how we started this, none of them
are happy.
None of them seem happy. None of them seem like they're balanced or well adjusted in life. It almost seems like these people that engage in this sort of like crazy behavior with what you said, like cutting off their hair, dyeing it, and just piercing themselves, whatever the hell they're doing, it's always like a cry for help, or it's they're masking their own insecurities, they're masking their own life's troubles and miseries under this like political umbrella. And there's, and like, it's like, oh, I'm not just some like, you know, crazy, you know, person who's just like sort of dropped off the wall. I am a feminist. That's why I'm doing this. I'm part of this grand noble cause, and that gives whatever they're doing legitimacy. It's almost kind of like, it's like a coping mechanism. It's kind of insane.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see the memes where they're like, when a woman's going through a mental breakdown or a life crisis, she gets bangs. That's like, she cuts her own bangs off. I mean, it's these people that are just completely breaking down, changing their image because they're unhappy with themselves. They're using any sort of artificial modification they can to try to make themselves happy because they don't want to fix the problem, the real problem, which it isn't their appearance. It's not, it's their mindset. It's their mentality. It's, you know, their dislike of themselves as a person. And I feel badly for them, but you know, you have to get the help that you need. You have to fix, you have to work on bettering yourself, and piercing yourself 50 times is not going to help that.
Right. But no one wants to be the bad guy. No one wants to be the asshole or the bitch or whatever. They don't want to tell people what they don't want to hear. They don't want to say, it's like, listen, you're getting fat, you're getting ugly, you're not like taking care of yourself and you're a mess. They just want to say, oh no, healthy at every size, you're great, slay queen, you're a queen, whatever. And it's like that's not helping. Like if I had a friend who was, you know, falling into like depression or drugs and he was like abusing himself, like as a friend, I would feel compelled to tell them, it's like, listen, get your shit together. You're a mess. Fix yourself up. But it seems society at large has just abandoned any sort of, you know, helpful criticism, even if, because they don't want to appear mean. They don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. It's part of like this, you know, this overall cultural thing where people are just pussies. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, that's basically it. It's the same thing they did with turning the media against Donald Trump. You know, they used the terms that we've been taught since we were in kindergarten in the anti-bullying seminars about being a bully. It's the same exact terminology that you're not allowed to. They use it with Donald Trump. They use it with anyone who's trying to help their friends. It might come off the wrong way. I get it. It's not the easiest to tell someone, like, stop eating, stop drinking. But
right.
Sometimes it's the right thing to do. It's helpful to do, but society is completely turned and they made it normal for that to not be okay, to let people, they want to just let people go, let people fall off the deep end. And they're easier to control that way. They're easier to keep with propaganda because they're constantly looking for something that's going to better their life, but they want to do it artificially. They're not the problem. They want to say society is a problem. And the left has given them their... love to give them the perfect opportunity with it, whether it's, you know, it's via feminism, socialism, you know, they say capitalists are bad, they say white men are bad. There's always someone to blame,
right? But never themselves.
Yeah.
And never looking into oneself, never, you know, taking responsibility for yourself. And like you said, you made a great point. It's easier to control someone. It's easier to manipulate a society. It's easier to be, you know, a tyrannical government if everyone is just, you know, a depressed, self-hating wreck of a human. If you have independent, strong-willed, strong people who have values, who believe in something greater than themselves, who have a sort of conscience and a history and can, you know, respect that, that's a dangerous society. That's a society you can't necessarily rule over. That's not a society you could, engage in tyrannical acts. But if you're just, you know, the purple hair screaming lunatic who's blaming all her problems and society's problems on some artificial construct like the patriarchy or white men or whatever it is, those are the idiots that you can manipulate and control, which is the sad part. But you also brought up something I wanted to touch on, bullying. I have a controversial opinion. I don't know if you share it, but basically I don't think bullying is necessarily a bad thing. I think, you know, I was bullied growing up. I think getting bullied is part of development. I think it builds people up and it builds character. It teaches you how to deal with real problems in the real world, because bullying happens in all shapes and forms, even when you're an adult. I mean, it goes by different names, but it certainly exists. And when you try to shield people from being bullied when they're young, they never find out how to deal with it or internalize it or cope with it or become stronger individuals. They just become sort of sheltered and kind of like bubble boys or bubble girls. And then the second, you know, they actually face like a real harsh dose of reality when they grow up, they can't handle it. And that's why we have like sort of this, you know, everyone's a child, like everyone's a man child growing up. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, obviously there's degrees. You can't have, you know, the kind of insane bullying. I mean, there's a balance with everything, but I think there's been this push, you know, part of, you know, maybe the participation trophy culture and all the other things that, you know, children need to be protected from bullying at all costs. You're never going to get rid of bullying. It needs to be, you know, you're going to have to expose it. You should teach people how to handle it better and fight back. I think that's the biggest problem. They never teach people how to fight back. It's always, oh, tell the teacher, tell the principal. But if you teach them to fight back, even if they get their ass kicked, it's always like a better thing than just taking it or hiding from it. Or I'm crazy. Maybe I'm crazy.
No, I think you're right. Like you said, it's moderation and there is a right and wrong way. But we have this, our generation particularly is it's a generation that's been sheltered. They were largely kept inside, hid from bullying. Like you said, tell the teacher, don't fight, like go and run and be a tattletale, like don't stand up for yourself. And now you have people that they don't like confrontation. They don't want to have any sort of discussion. They don't want to ask for things that they want. They can't take criticism. They can't debate. There's anything that involves any slight confrontation, we cannot handle, because our generation cannot handle, because we weren't taught how to handle it.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, we could talk about this for hours. I mean, it was great to talk about something other than politics, just sort of cultural and social things. But I do want to drift into politics a bit because you do a lot of commentary on what's going on in Italy, Italian politics. One of my last podcasts, I had the international secretary for Lega Giovani, Davide Quadri, who joined us. Yes, he's a great guy. You know, we had to put some subtitles on because his accent was so thick, but very smart guy. He gave us a little bit of a rundown in terms of what's going on in Italy, the political situation there, in particular with Matteo Salvini, et cetera, the prosecution, all this stuff. There's a lot of interesting parallels between American politics and Italian politics. It is interesting what we're seeing in terms of, you know, the rise of populism, you know, the deep state, these runaway courts, these runaway prosecutors. But I wanted to touch on it a bit with you. What is going on in Italy? I mean, there were the lockdowns. There's Salvini was getting prosecuted for doing his job. Is Italy on the right path, or are they descending into a similar situation that the United States is?
I think they're in a way descending into a similar situation, but because of snap elections and because of the amount of political parties, how there's not a majority, there's so many things in Italian politics and the way their government and society runs that is different than the US, to where it's, although temporarily it's the wrong path, at the end of the day, it will be the right path. It's kind of accelerationism. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have the polls here. Salvini's party, the Lega, they're ahead in all the polls. PD is pretty high too, the Democrat Party. It's the establishment left party. But overall, center right has the majority, with between Berlusconi's Forza Italia, Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia, and Salvini's League. And the Five Star Movement is completely falling. They used to have a government with the League, then they went with the establishment, and they were supposed to be the populist party. They were supposed to be kind of what we saw here with the progressive left, the AOCs, and now they've sold out. The Five Star Movement has sold out to the Democrat establishment, like you saw in many ways here with Joe Biden's winning the Democrat nomination. Yeah, that a lot of people were very upset with. The same thing happened in Italy, and they just abandoned the party. And a lot of them went to the League, Fratelli d'Italia. Some of them went center right, the ones who were truly anti-establishment. And some of them actually went to the Democrat establishment, but they were just mad because, like, even though they went to the establishment, they were just didn't want to. They're just Italians. But yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy because there's a lot European politics and just politics within a multi-party structure. I mean, I find more interesting just because, you know, when we talk about American politics, there's a lot of factions within the Republican Party. So the Republican Party is almost like a umbrella org. The Democrat Party is like an umbrella org, and they have all these internal factions. I mean, but it's more honest if you just had a multi-party system, because, you know, then it's very clear cut. There's no internal factions. I mean, there would still be some, but it's not as ideological because you could just form your own party. In some ways, I see it's better in a place like Italy and a place like in many European countries, because they have more competition between the parties. So if there was a party run by, say, Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan that just betrayed all their values, they would get crushed in the next election, in a snap election or whatever it is, because there's more competition. There's more, you know, parties are formed constantly. There's not sort of this entrenched political establishment necessarily. I mean, maybe there is to an extent, but, you know, what we saw in Italy, I mean, with all these different movements, even the Five Star, when they first came up, I mean, they were a populist, anti-EU, anti-establishment party. They obviously betrayed their base, and now they're suffering for it, which is a good thing. I think it's competition. Yeah. Wouldn't you agree?
I think it's definitely a good thing. I think there are upsides and downsides to a multi-party system. And obviously it's not just like switching the number of parties. There are other governmental processes that have to change along with it. But the upside to it is that, you know, we have a lot of conversations on conservative Twitter. I know you and I are always tweeting about it. The America First faction of the Republican Party, the pro-Trump faction versus the Mitch McConnells, the Paul Ryans. And we don't really have, we like guess, but we don't really have a good gauge in numbers versus where you just have the polling of the individual parties in Italy. So it's very easy to see like who's the nationalist, who's the populist, what percentage, because even across party lines, we're able to see how big the nationalist populist movement is. There are leftists who are nationalist populists in Italy as well.
Yep.
As conservatives. So it's a lot easier to see in terms of that. And that's why I love being able to just go look up the polls, and I have them all right here in front of me. It's much easier in Italy, I find, than the States for that.
Right. Because it's clear cut, but you bring up a good point that Italy and many other European countries do have this sort of left-wing, maybe economic, but socially conservative or nationalist movements. And, you know, there is that's something that's missing in the U.S., which is interesting because I feel like a lot of people in the U.S. would align with that ideology, more left-wing economically, but more socially, either moderate or conservative, and certainly more, you know, in terms of, you know, national sovereignty, strong borders, strong trade protectionism, et cetera. That's been sort of until the rise of Trump, pretty much been brushed under the rug. It existed more in Europe, and those kind of partnerships between, say, you know, a right-wing populist and a left-wing populist could exist and could form a governing coalition in Italy. We're seeing maybe the beginnings of it here in the U.S. with, you know, the Josh Hawleys and the AOCs of the world coming together on stimulus checks. What does it mean for a place like Italy? Do you think there could be something with Lega in terms of, you know, because they've gone under a lot of rebranding. They dropped Nord. Now they appeal to Southern Italians. It's not so much regionalist as it is, you know, just advocating a federalist system, but not necessarily pro-North over, you know, anti-South. They've embraced more of a clear-cut populist kind of right-wing message. Do you think all these things are sort of helping it grow and paving the way for the future?
I think they are. I think that there are certain... when you look at like the leaders of the party that are kind of like their main candidates, like you would say Salvini is their Trump, and the way he speaks to the people is very helpful. His rallies are in completely insane, nothing that's ever been seen before in Italy. And the rebranding, like you said, dropping North, and they're actually gaining a lot of traction in the South slowly more and more. However, still, when you look at it, it's what's driving the votes for the League in regional elections in the South is actually Fratelli d'Italia and Forza Italia, mostly Fratelli d'Italia, however, because there a lot of people still hold, a lot of my friends in Sicily say, as a Sicilian, how can you support Salvini? And it's simply because of the Lega Nord when he wanted to split the country, right, when that was a whole thing, and they hold grudges there. They don't forget in Sicily. And so a lot of the South, they'll vote for his party if there's enough encouragement from Meloni and Berlusconi. However, he's done a phenomenal job, but the party still has a long way to go in terms of that. And it's not to any fault of their own. They're making great progress. They're doing the best they can, but you know, the Sicilians and the Southern Italians just won't forget.
Well, Italy, it's crazy. Of all the countries you can think of in the world that would benefit from a federal system, something akin to what we have in the U.S., it would be Italy, because there's been such historic differences between the regions of Italy, between North and South, within the South, within the North. You know, for most of its history, they were independent, you know, city states or independent kingdoms. There's differences in the dialects and the accents. I mean, sometimes they're not even mutually intelligible. So a place like Italy would benefit greatly from a more federalized system where you could have these regions that have greater local autonomy, greater local control, more of an American style system, if you want to describe it like that. So something like Lega promoting that, I think, is actually a positive for Italy, including the South. The South, you know, really got hurt after unification because a lot of the resources and the government was all based in the North and the wealth shifted to the North. Having a more regional approach could benefit the South. Maybe that's helping. Maybe that's getting translated into, you know, part of the policy, part of the pitch to appeal. But I also want to just talk about, you know, Salvini himself. I mean, he's obviously, you know, becoming a target of political retribution, so to speak, from these runaway prosecutors and these courts and all the deep state, if you want to say it, in Italy. What is going on with him, his case? Is he going to be behind bars? Is he really going to suffer for this? Or is this going to backfire and blow up in their faces?
I think there's a middle ground. I don't think, you know, I think he'll be okay in the end. He'll be vindicated. However, I don't think it's really going to blow up in their faces because it's such a corrupt system. It's the same thing that happened with Trump's impeachment. They're effectively the same exact scenario. There was no wrongdoing done. Salvini did his job as interior minister, just as President Trump did his job. And for those who don't know, Salvini was on trial for kidnapping because he closed the ports and made a boat full of illegal immigrants had to stay at sea for 3 extra days. So they charged him with kidnapping. And he's been on trial for the past few months. But he's wrongfully persecuted for doing his job. That's all he did. And he'll be set free on that standpoint, but it's not going to backfire on them. And, you know, people say the impeachment hurt the Democrats. It did at the time, but the last few months of the election, it wasn't talked about at all. a month or two after he was impeached, we didn't talk about it. It didn't blow, you know, no one's holding the Democrats accountable for what they did to President Trump. You know,
it's true. And it's another great parallel, like to bring it back to what we said earlier. I mean, it's almost insane. When I first, you know, read about this, I'm sure a lot of people aren't aware about it because they don't follow Italian politics. The fact that the interior minister, whose job and mandate is to enforce border controls, is to enforce immigration laws, et cetera, was charged with kidnapping because he wouldn't let these boats filled with economic migrants. These are not refugees. These are economic migrants from Africa that are just either seeking welfare, seeking job opportunities, whatever it is. They're not fleeing Syria. They're not fleeing a war-torn region. They're coming from, you know, areas that are not war-torn. They just happen to be not as wealthy as Western Europe. They're coming into Italy and they're bringing drugs, crime, et cetera, all the things Trump talked about. He is getting charged with kidnapping, which is the most insane charge ever. I mean, I really hope, I mean, you know, the Italian law is different. It's not common law. I don't know about precedent and all that, but, you know, I could speak on a theoretical level. The precedent that someone could get prosecuted as a governing official for this, I mean, it also seems like they seem to have thrown out, you know, the immunity that's given to, you know, ministers and things like that. I mean, you usually get immunity from these types of things. Has that been thrown out?
Well, Italy is a bit of the Wild West in terms of, you know, we don't have the protections we do in the US in a lot of cases. And, you know, in Matteo's case, all it took was a vote to put him to trial, and they didn't have the majority. The government hates him. His own government that he worked with for over a year, he was a part of, worked hand in hand with them, and they persecuted him for it. In Italy, like I said, it's the Wild West. You don't really have the protections there.
And majorities don't make right. They don't set morality. If anything, majorities sometimes are the ones in the wrong and destroy morality.
Yeah. And you have, it's an interesting system over there too, because of the snap elections and because they keep trying to delay the elections due to COVID. I'm looking at the Prime Minister Conte's approval numbers right here. And I mean, the faith in the Prime Minister currently, the one that's speaking out against Salvini, that put him on trial effectively, and that testified at his trial, over 52% of Italians have zero faith in him. Another 8.5% have little faith in, or almost no faith in him. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, Matteo.
That's why they're preventing. They don't want to have an election because they know if they had an election now,
they would take it in a heartbeat. Yeah. Matteo Salvini, along with Meloni and Berlusconi, the center right, they're all up in the polls. They're all, you know, they go up and down a bit, all the different parties. But, you know, Fratelli d'Italia with Meloni has absolutely skyrocketed in the past year in terms of, I mean, they're up about, I think, 7 in the past year, give or take. The League jumped from, in the past 2 years, from 17%. They were up to 34 during the European elections in 2019, and they're sitting about 23-24% now. But I mean, the center right would take it in a heartbeat. And I was actually talking to one of my good friends from Italy on Twitter today about how they were telling me how there's supposed to be spring elections, some regional elections for mayors and such.
Looks like we lost Sophia. Here she is. She just rejoined. Thank God. Oh. That was weird. I think Conti heard you and wanted
probably
you to stop speaking. Yeah, or the Chinese. But you were saying you had a friend and they were saying,
yes,
something.
The in Italy, they have a regional election coming up in the spring that elects mayors, and it's in the spring, and they're already trying to postpone it or cancel it because of COVID. They want to postpone or cancel an election over COVID that's months away. They tried to do it with the September elections. Conte knows if anything goes to election, the League will sweep. Like, even in far left, historically far left districts, in the last elections in September, the League made incredible gains, even if they didn't.
Emilia Romagna and stuff, yeah.
Yes. Yes, there's a good article on my site by Fabio Bozzo, who works for the League and Salvini, an amazing piece where he broke it all down, what was happening in the different regions. And Conte is doing everything he can to stay in power. And unfortunately, when you have a country that's so Wild West as Italy, and not like we have in the US, you know, you can change things. You can call for snap elections. The president can, not just the prime minister, but the president can kind of weigh in and change the rules of it as you go. There's right. a lot of gray area there, and it's making it really hard for Salvini and the center right people to get the power that they really deserve, that the public wants.
Right. And there, and it's interesting because, again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but again, the parallels here are that the political establishment in both Italy and the United States took advantage of COVID to suppress, to change the rules, to change the electoral systems in order to benefit the powers that be in the United States, in the case to fight against Trump, to make the situations in many of these different states, you know, with mail-in ballots, with getting rid of voter ID, getting rid of signature matches, all that stuff to make it easier to commit fraud, to expand the voter rolls almost, you know, fraudulently, et cetera. And then in the case of Italy, preventing an election from happening and getting true representation, because the current makeup of parliament in Italy is not representative of the current wishes of the people. And they know that, so they're running against the clock. But I also want to talk about, because you mentioned your site a bit. What are you doing at Bucalupo? What's the objective? What's the mission? How has it been going for you? Give us a bit of a background about your website.
So the website is really just an Italian-American website. I do both Italian and American news and opinion on politics. I have some great contributors, both from both countries, and mostly focused on American politics, but trying to, because there's not a huge interest in Italian politics in the US because Italy doesn't translate its news. So no one here really knows what's going on. So I'm slowly trying to build interest in the United States for what's happening in Italy. And I also have a lot of cultural articles that go up on the site. I really want to, over time, kind of move it towards a cultural website from a conservative perspective, because like we were saying earlier, you know, the left controls the media and they have a Cosmopolitan, Vogue with Harry Styles and a dress on the cover. And we, I mean, if a woman wants to read a beauty article, she doesn't have another place to go. So I right. eventually kind of want to take this from a political conservative site. I want to be able to emphasize the policies and the discussions that need to be had to bring back traditional gender roles, to bring back a traditional balanced society. And then I want to make my site kind of change it as time goes on to help deliver that.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I feel like a lot of conservatives sort of retreat into their kind of echo chamber ghettos online where they only interact with each other. But we have to fight the culture war by providing value and providing other sources of things that are maybe outside of the political realm, but culturally, like you were just talking about, in order to fight the left. If we just surrender all the ground, they're just going to dominate everything. So that's awesome. But then I know we're pushing up here on the 45-minute mark. I just want to touch on another topic that's super important, really close to my heart. I know we were talking about it before. Pasta. Yes. I love pasta.
Very important.
Very important. I started a Instagram cooking show, the cooking show no one asked for, where I make pasta. I make an episode maybe every month, but you're a great pasta cook, chef, however you want to describe it. We were talking about what pisses us off about people making pasta in the U.S. I mean, I hate how we add cream to everything. Like, oh my God, there are the pasta cream. Dishes that could be so much healthier and are actually not that bad for you if you just use natural ingredients or just a few ingredients. But there's something about, you know, when Americans like to cook pasta or whatever, they just add more ingredients that are necessary. They add cream, they add all this crap. And it just tastes unnatural. It tastes gross and it makes it so unhealthy. Am I crazy for saying this? Or
no, not at all. They add way too much cream. I mean, most recipes don't call for cream that they put cream in. They break the pasta like spaghetti and angel hair before it goes in the pot. Never break the pasta. Do not break the pasta.
You don't break pasta.
And they cook the shit out of it. No one likes al dente. No one appreciates al dente over here. There's some restaurants that I've gone to where I've like said to the waiters and the chef, like, this is the perfect al dente pasta. I want to commend you on it. And they're like, most people tell us, send the pasta back to the kitchen to get it cooked more. I don't know what's wrong with Americans in terms of pasta, but.
And they add a ton of sugar to like even tomato sauces and stuff. Like it's everything just is so backwards and mind boggling in terms of how they cook pasta. I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
Because Italian cooking, unlike, say, French cooking or something, it's actually very simple. It's usually just a few locally sourced ingredients. It's not, like, pretentious. It's not, like, really crazy. Like, some of the most popular dishes people think of, whether it's, like, you know, carbonara or whatever it is, or pesto, et cetera, you know, bolognese, whatever, they're not, like, crazy in terms of how to make them or in terms of ingredients.
No, because we're making so much. In Italy, we make so much food. Like, you have a Sunday meal, it's, like, 7-8 courses, and it's all, like, dishes that we consider like fancy, intricate dishes in restaurants. But when they're made right, they have few ingredients. They're easy to make. Most of them, you just go ahead and like put the ingredients in a pot, let them cook all day. It's really, we make things very simple because we cook for a lot of food for a lot of people and a lot of courses. And Americans just have to like complicate things because fancy.
Either fancy or just laziness. Like, I think the reason, like, for example, like there's a lot of cream used is because you can make a pasta creamy naturally with the pasta water, with, you know, just, you know, mantecatura, just mixing it up really quickly.
It's the same thing with panna cotta. When no one makes a right panna cotta, you're supposed to just cook the cream till it turns into basically gelatin. Instead, people just add gelatin. The texture's worse. It doesn't taste as good, but no one has the patience to cook the cream correctly. Right. So they're just like gelatin.
Exactly. It's just kind of laziness. But what is your, what have you been cooking lately? What's your favorite pasta dish to cook? I mean, I brought up, I think off the record to you earlier, that, you know, I'm a big fan of Roman pasta. I love carbonara. I love matriciana. I love, you know, all that stuff. I love making it. It's easy, quick and easy to make. It's delicious. You were a little, you know, you don't like making it because you can't find the best pancetta or guanciale, whatever. Obviously some things are hard to find, but what have you been cooking lately? What's your favorite stuff to cook?
My favorite Roman dish to cook is cacio e pepe.
Okay,
I absolutely
beautiful.
Love it. I people when you order in a restaurant, it's usually not done right. Usually they put cream in it, but
it's so stupid. There's no cream in it.
Amazing dish. Arancini is. I mean, I prefer risotto actually, probably about the same risotto and pasta, but arancini, Sicilian street food, just deep fried risotto balls stuffed with cheese, and then I love a good like risotto with seafood in it, some limoncello.
All right, I'm getting hungry. I'm probably going to be cooking after this, probably some carbonara or something. But this is
I'm going to go to the kitchen after this.
Okay, there we go.
Back to where I'm supposed to be.
Get back in there after this. This is your only exception to come on the Waxcast. But this has been a great episode. I'm really happy you came on. I want to have you back on
again.
Thank
you for having me.
No, I appreciate it. Let our viewers know, let the Waxcast crew know where they can follow you. I will also say that while you were talking, we had a ton of comments just yelling ravioli, ravioli, give me the ravioli, mozzarella, calamar, sorpresa, boopity boppity, boppity boopity. So I didn't put them up on screen because, you know, these are very offensive to both Italians and women. I don't know who did it because it just says Facebook user. But anyway.
I have a feeling.
Yes, yes. Gabagool, which is just like butchered Italian from The Sopranos. But anyway, where can people follow you, Sophia, for your latest writings, commentary, and pasta recipes?
I'll put some pasta recipes on my website if they're in demand, but bucalupo.com, BUCALUPO. You can follow me on Twitter at Sophia I Carboni and on Instagram at SI Carboni.
Carboni. I was saying Carbone. My bad.
Well, it's supposed to be Carbone, but American. None of them.
You can also follow your dad on Twitter. He has great tweets.
He
has
great tweets. Steve.
You can follow Steve. He wrote some like Italian poem one day. I was reading it. I was like, wow, I had some tears reading it. I forgot what he was writing about, like walking to the beach or something. It was really beautiful stuff. But you could definitely follow him. He has a good Twitter. He's your biggest Twitter fan. But anyway, guys, tune in soon. If you're listening on iTunes, don't forget to leave us a 5-star review, and we'll have more of the Waxcast coming to you very soon.